May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice. Justices, good morning. Paul Wallace on behalf of the appellant, the State of Delaware, in this matter. First, I'd like to thank the Court for giving me an opportunity to appear a little earlier than originally scheduled. I appreciate that very much. This case poses a very interesting question that I don't know is fully answered by current Delaware law, and that is, what do we mean, or what does the Court mean when it says that a lower court should give a magistrate's determination of probable cause great deference or substantial deference? And in the original panel argument, we talked quite a bit about what those standards might mean and whether or not other applicable standards of review are helpful here. And the state suggests, as it did in its briefing, and still suggests, that it does. What it comes down to, basically, is a clearly erroneous type standard.
And I gather that was not the standard that the trial court applied?
Well, the trial court, time and again, did, in fact, write...
Did the trial court apply that standard?
No.
If the trial court... what standard did the trial court apply?
It appeared to be a wholly de novo review. The court said it was going, that it understood it should give great deference to the magistrate's finding, but in practice and in what the court did when you read the opinion, okay, it's all de novo.
Just to narrow the issue, yeah. If we were to find that the standard that the trial court applied was the correct standard, is there any error here? Or to say it differently, does your position depend on our adopting a different standard?
No, Your Honor. I think that if the court said that the great deference standard was to be applied in the way that the Superior Court did, I still believe that there is error, because there are certain factual errors that are made and certain inferences that are made that don't...
So your position is, even under the standard that was applied, there's a reversible error, but by the way, we'd like you to change the standard.
We're not change the standard, but define the standard better, because
articulate it differently.
Yes.
Why do we need to do that?
Because I believe that this case is a case in point, Your Honor, that what the court did was said, and I don't want to say gave lip service, because I think that's demeaning, but said, I will give great deference, but did...
Well, why shouldn't we use the exact terms that the United States Supreme Court has used? Why do we have to define words that they have not defined?
Well, I don't know that the court needs to define them differently and call it clearly erroneous or anything like that, but needs to further explicate what substantial deference or great deference does. I believe the panel decision did it properly, that said, if there is evidence of substance, if there are some facts that would uphold the finding of the magistrate, then the great deference standard is met. I don't know that had been clearly articulated before the panel's decision. I think we always use the term substantial deference or great deference in a finding of a substantial basis to find probable cause, but never really defined what great deference or substantial deference would mean in a practical term. Because if it had, then I would suggest respectfully, as this court did, the original panel decision, it would see that the court wasn't applying that great deference standard correctly. That if there is a reasonable view based on some facts, within the four corners,
but
that the magistrate
should redefine or further define the terms that are in use to reach the result of that you're seeking?
No, and the court did not do so in the panel decision. The panel said, this is substantial deference, and here's what substantial deference means. That, I don't believe, had ever been articulated as clearly as it was in the panel decision, and I think that would really end the review here.
My question is, do we have to define what substantial deference means to reach the result that you're seeking?
I don't know that the court has to say it means X. I do think that the court could look at it and say, this court, the Superior Court, did not give the magistrate substantial deference here, because while time and again it said substantial deference is the standard, you can never see in the opinion where it says, the magistrate said this, I should defer to that finding. It always said, the facts in the affidavit are this, but they could be explained by other things. Never saying, there's a reasonable view by the magistrate, it's supported by facts in the affidavit, I should defer to those. as the Superior Court.
Well, putting that argument to one side, and going with the narrowest argument that you're making, why do you contend that there's error even under the mode of application that was utilized by the trial court?
Well, first, in giving de novo review, I do not believe that de novo review includes trying to make explanations for facts found or that are otherwise in the affidavit. What it does is say, how do we apply those? Here, what the state suggests respectfully is you had two separate confidential informants from the record who do not know each other, are not working together in any way, each of which are saying different things about Mr. Holden that come together, that he is still selling, that he's selling from his home, that he drives certain cars, things like that. There are things that the police are able to, in fact, corroborate through their investigation. Who's living there, the car, things like that.
Before you go on, can you just tell me in a sentence why what the court did, even under the standard that you don't like, was error in a sentence? And then you can develop it.
By substituting facts and excuses for facts that were within the probable cause affidavit. That, the state suggests, is not de novo review.
By substituting facts that were not in the affidavit.
Yes, facts or what that court believed to be weaknesses.
And those facts were?
Well, for instance, that if in fact the confidential informant was correct, why wasn't there heavy foot traffic? Why wasn't there this? Why wasn't there that? As to Mr. Pfeiffer, why, sure, he just left that house. Sure, he may have been deceptive about where he had just been. And sure, he had oxycodone pills, the very things the confidential informants had said he's now selling, that Holden was now selling from his home. But the police didn't do enough. They didn't know whether or not maybe he had a real prescription for it, even though he said, I have a prescription bottle, it's not in the car. They didn't, you know, he could have walked in there with it. The court engaged in what I suggest respectfully this court has warned against, this hyper-technical, I use Maxwell as the best elucidation of that concept, and that is, you don't try to make up innocent explanations for this evidence. What you do is you look at the evidence, and specifically when you have a warrant that's been issued, you give deference to the magistrate that they took a view on that, and that the magistrate said, that's evidence that he just got that oxycodone out of that house, and that it would be there at this time. And that I should issue that warrant, which was issued within an hour of picking up Mr. Pfeiffer.
The bottom line, at least as I understand your argument, is while we could, as we have done for the phrase substantial evidence, try to define great deference and put meat on the bones of the concept of great deference, we really don't have to do that because what happened in this particular case was the trial judge decided that just looking at the affidavit itself, that the magistrate erred because the magistrate overlooked negative inferences that could have been drawn and steps that could have been taken that could have improved probable cause, such as a controlled by or other circumstances, looking to the practice that the judge had seen in other cases. But the real role is to look at the four corners of this affidavit and see if you can distill from the affidavit sufficient facts to justify probable cause. You do that regardless of your view of what could have been added or what could have been inferred differently, there's still probable cause to issue the warrant.
Yes,
that's basically it?
Yes. That basically in applying great deference, as the court should have done, you don't look for what's not there. You look for what's there. And that is what is there, give a magistrate of reasonable common sense enough to believe there's a fair probability that the evidence is there and that they should seek it. That is where I suggest respectfully the Superior Court went wrong in this regard. We had suggested in our briefing that perhaps drawing out what substantial deference means or great deference means a little more is helpful so that error is not made again. If there's no other questions from the court.
Yeah, well, there is, I thought, evidence in the four corners of the affidavit the defendant admitted to someone that he had decided to sell in a, from his house rather than go out on the road because of the risk. Doesn't that constitute a fact how should that fact have been treated?
Well, Your Honor, the state suggests that actually you had two different confidential informants who said he's now selling from his home. One explained more that he believed he beat those other charges. He's been stopped in his car since then. He's not going to take that chance anymore. He's selling from his home now instead. The state suggests that was enough. The defense suggests, well, we don't believe that that confidential informant was corroborated enough that you should be able to rely upon that. You should strike that guy out. We suggest when the two confidential informants work together, and then you have that final act of Mr. Pfeiffer coming that night and the reasonable inference therefrom as to how that went out, that, in fact, he certainly, a magistrate could believe, he bought those drugs in that shoe drive residence that he had just been in. They caught him basically red-handed. He had them in his hands when they stopped him at that shopping center. The reasonable inference is there's a fair probability he is doing exactly what the confidential informant said he was doing, and that there are drugs there now because we have somebody who just left with what they said he's selling. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, members of the court, good afternoon. Tom Foley on behalf of Ms. Lusby. I'm going to reserve some time for my colleague, Mr. Deckers, who represents Mr. Holden. We're all familiar with the expression, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And simply put, regarding the standard, that's what we're asking the court to do simply nothing, that we have a long-standing standard regarding judicial review of search warrants that the U.S. Supreme Court and every federal court and every court in the land and this court time and time again has used the exact standard that the trial court used in this case. And so I don't think there's a point here where we need to tinker with something that's not clear. We all know that search warrants start with the magistrate finding that under the totality of circumstances there's probable cause that the contraband or evidence of a crime will be found in a particular location, such as a residence. Now, the reviewing court,
So your first point, as I understand it, is essentially we don't need to define substantial basis. Ultimately, it's sort of like looking at the reflection within two mirrors. You could keep on going and then define the terms that define substantial basis and then define those terms that define the terms, and we've got enough definitions to work with.
My point, if there had been a problem with these terms, it long ago would have surfaced in the federal courts, this court, some other court. It's never, ever been a problem until the state, in this case, says, we think we need more clarity. And let me tell you what I think the terms mean. When a reviewing court must pay great deference, I think that simply gives you a line of sight for the reviewing court, meaning if it's a close call, defer. If you're on the fence, defer. If reasonable minds can disagree, defer. But the Supreme Court in Gates and this court has said time and time again, nevertheless, despite great deference, the reviewing court has a duty to still make sure that there's a substantial basis for the magistrate to have issued the warrant to find probable cause. And substantial is the key word. It means more than something. Substantial means ample.
Does it compare at all to our recognized definition of what constitutes substantial evidence when we're reviewing an agency's work?
I think it's close, but it's different. In one agency law, here we're talking about the entry into a person's home that's protected by the Fourth Amendment.
I understand.
But I think substantial is its common meaning, ample, weighty. And I looked up some, definitions and some synonyms. Major, material, meaningful, important, significant, weighty. Antonyms, inconsequential, little, minor, negligible, slight. So we know what it means.
Well, that's not how the Supreme Court looked at it in Illinois versus Gates, they were comparing the term and to other cases which had mere conclusory statements. So doesn't that suggest that as long as there are facts in the affidavit that are more than conclusions, that that's the what you focus on?
It is, but it's what's the difference between rubber stamping and great deference? And what the Supreme Court has taught us, and this court has repeated, is there's sort of two things that go into any Fourth Amendment analysis. It's information plus corroboration. Whether we're talking about reasonable suspicion to detain somebody, a warrantless arrest, or the search of a house. It's information, which can be broken down to detail and reliability, and then corroboration. And corroboration is a big thing. So it's not a big deal if you have a bunch of finger pointing, as you do in this case, that Holden's back in the drug game, that Holden's boasting, that Holden has drugs in his house. When you don't have anything in the warrant to tell us how that information came about, such as we were with him, we were in his house, we saw it. Your Honor actually wrote the opinion in LeGrand where there was a probationer who gave information saying that Mr. LeGrand was had guns and ammo in his house, and they confirmed he was on probation. They confirmed the address. The probationer said, how do I know? I saw him. I was with him on January 8th, whatever year that was. And they confirmed all that, but Your Honor said they never corroborated. There wasn't the independent police work to build that bridge between the information, which I call the finger pointing, and the place to be searched. In this case,
well, why doesn't the stop of the purchaser of drugs just minutes earlier with drugs in his possession provide the corroboration?
Because it's a big jump to call him a purchaser. He didn't say he purchased them there. He simply had pills on his person. He was in the house for 10 minutes. That's it. And the judge found that that was insufficient, and I don't think it's even a close call. There has to be something more than just one guy was seen in a house. We stop him. He's got six pills on him.
But wouldn't it be fair to say that the trial judge's opinion was basically a de novo review of the affidavit of probable cause, saying, I know what the magistrate found, but I'm looking at it differently, and I think this is not that significant, and that was not corroborated, and this is not enough, that's not enough, so I'm making my independent judgment as to whether it was a valid warrant.
Well, I think that the trial judge did such a good job of announcing the standard and said repeatedly, even with great deference, there's not enough here. So I think de novo, I think she was thorough in why she was quashing the warrant, but it really wasn't de novo. She was simply saying there's not enough here, and she paid a lot of attention on the lack of corroboration and made a...
Said, anyone can write an opinion and say that the evidence should be examined for a preponderance of the evidence in favor of a particular party, and yet write an opinion that demonstrates that the analysis reflects a conclusive presumption is what would need to be required in order to reach that result. So I've probably done that when I was a trial judge and probably got reversed for it. That's easy to do. The question is, whatever standard you announced, did you adhere to it? You used the phrase earlier, totality of the circumstances. Do you believe that the totality of the circumstances includes a trial judge reviewing a magistrate's conclusion to authorize the issuance of a warrant to include different inferences than the magistrate may have drawn from the same facts, to reach conclusions that additional information should have been provided in order to reach the conclusion that the standard of reasonable probability that a crime is being committed at the scene or that particular items that constitute contraband were at this particular location? What does the totality of the circumstances analysis really mean in your argument?
Well, that you do look at everything and
it's there or include things that aren't there?
Everything is there, but I think the court in the panel argument, the question was raised, is it really fair for the trial judge to talk about what isn't there versus what is there? And I think that's a fair question. But when we talk about sort of, you know, substantial, in the law, we compare and contrast all the time because that's sort of how we find our line. And I'm hoping to have a substantial meal on Thursday, but if I show up at my brother's house and it's a grilled cheese sandwich and a bowl of tomato soup, and someone says, "Hey, Tom, was it a substantial Thanksgiving meal?" I'm going to say, "You know what? Not really. And let me tell you what was missing." And yeah, I'm going to go through all the turkey and everything else. So I think it's sort of along that lines. Is the court saying, look, these are the kind of things that would have made a difference to me. They're not there. So she's not really substituting. She's simply saying, these items aren't there in the four corners.
Well, isn't she, if she says this is what would have made a difference to me? It shouldn't matter what the difference would be to her, should it?
I agree.
It should be whether the magistrate on these facts should have found the existence of probable cause or not.
I agree wholeheartedly. It's not what she would have found. It's whether a reasonable magistrate, whether this magistrate had enough meat on the bone to pull the trigger. And she is simply saying there's not enough meat in the bone because there's really no corroboration. And the fact that you have Mr. Pfeiffer getting stopped coming out of the house, has pills on him, that by itself is simply not enough to grant the entry into someone's home.
Well, he had pills on him. He had six pills. He said he had a prescription, but he had no prescription bottle or any other indication that he had a prescription. So it's not just that he had six pills.
He may have been lying about whether or not he had a prescription, but that doesn't mean that the pills came from the residence in question. That's a whole other jump. So whether he's being hinky,
is it a reasonable inference that they did on these facts?
I don't find that.
Since they're not in a prescription container?
That's a couple jumps. It's too many jumps.
Getting back to your comment that I wouldn't find that and that arguably the trial court judge was not reviewing the facts de novo. If two reasonable minds could differ as to whether this affidavit has enough information in it to support a warrant, doesn't that mean we go with what the magistrate said?
Absolutely.
And did the trial court say that no reasonable person could have found probable cause here?
She essentially, it's a ruling. She's saying that this was so lacking of an affidavit, which I believe it is, that she found no magistrate could have issued a warrant on those facts.
Didn't the trial court actually find that the trial court would not have issued a warrant on this affidavit, as opposed to no rational judge could have done it?
I didn't read that way just because her standard, she talks so much about she has to, you know, pay great deference to the magistrate. And so she's either saying those things just for the sport of it or she means it. And I take it that she means it.
Well, let's try to test a little bit more deeply the question that Justice Berger asked. Let's start with Mr. Pfeiffer and the six oxycodone pills. Reasonable persons could draw completely opposite inferences from the facts that were in the affidavit. Is that correct? That is. We know that when he was stopped out in the shopping center outside after he had left the home,
correct,
he had these pills in his person. We don't know whether he brought the pills into the house and then brought them out, in which case there was no sale, or he had no pills when he went in but had them when he went out, in which case there was. Those are the two opposite inferences that could be drawn from the facts that were on the affidavit. What was the magistrate obligated to find?
The magistrate? Well, I think there's a difference between speculation and reasonable inferences, and so I think that's speculative that the pills came from Holden's residence.
Well, isn't it equally speculative that they didn't?
That they didn't, sure. And so I think, you want enough corroboration where you don't have to rely on speculation.
Well, corroboration is just another way of saying there needs to be a greater weight of evidence pointing toward the likelihood that Pfeiffer got those pills from the house. Is that right?
Correct.
You can create that greater quantum of evidence, you know, by corroboration. There may be some other way to do it, too. But right now, you have, let's assume, equally opposite inferences. My question is, under the, you know, under the test that was applied by the court, on the one hand, and under a substantial deference test, what would be the outcome? Or what should be the outcome?
That's not enough, because the substantial great deference is, you know, lines you up. Substantial basis is still what is in the four corners. And if you come to a point where, at best, Pfeiffer, it's speculation, that's not enough to get inside a house. And because the other thing is,
when you say speculation, do we have equal, opposite, inferences?
Equal speculation. It has to be more concrete.
Equal speculation when this is a prescription drug. We're not talking about cocaine, for which no prescription ever issues, or to my knowledge anyway, legally.
Not in Delaware.
But oxycodone is a prescription drug. How is this equally balanced when somebody's carrying around only six and there's no prescription, and there's no prescription container with a label reflecting that a prescription issued by a particular doctor? How do you call that equipoise?
Well, Pfeiffer said he had a prescription and said he was a bottle in the car. They couldn't find one. But we don't know whether he had a prescription or not, because some people don't always carry the prescriptions in a prescription bottle. Who knows?
Well,
but what we're making...
You really think empirically most people don't carry a prescription narcotic in the container in which it was issued?
We don't know, but there's plenty of people don't. But to make the jump that Pfeiffer has pills illegally or without a prescription is a different question than
it's
whether...
It's not a finding of fact. It's a reasonable inference that if you're issued a prescription narcotic, oxycodone is a heavy painkiller. It's not unreasonable to assume that if you're carrying six naked pills and you can produce no proof that they issued as a result of a prescription, what's the speculation that makes it equally assume that he's carrying them six naked pills or he got them from this particular building, given the other facts in the affidavit?
I just don't know how the court can infer that because Pfeiffer has six pills
well,
on his person.
Is it unreasonable to infer that? Is it more reasonable to infer the contrary, or are they equally balanced inferences?
I'd say they're equally balanced, but I think in terms of whether or not that gets you into a house, it's still not enough. Because that's the only item you have that starts pointing, well, maybe the pills came from Holden cells. Maybe.
Other than information that said
maybe
he was selling oxycodone out of his house.
Uncorroborated. From informants that never told us how they knew that, never were in his house, never saw him in possession, never saw him selling.
Okay, there was no control by, and the informants didn't claim that they were there and saw it. I understand that. But you were asked earlier by one of my colleagues, isn't the mere fact that someone just walked out of the house with six naked oxycodone pills some corroboration?
No, because we don't know who walked out of the house with them.
Okay.
Does the record reflect these particular pills, the dosage? Is it a once every 12 hours kind of dosage, or is it something different than that?
There's nothing in the affidavit that speaks toward dosage. I think the affidavit mentioned they were 30 milligrams. I remember just that was the only thing I mentioned about them. Nothing else.
Is it a reasonable inference that six pills is more than one day's dosage?
I don't know. But I again, we're making jumps that the pills came from Holden's house, and there's nothing to corroborate that. That really is just speculation. We know that the guy had pills. Now, if you stop three or four people on the same night and they all have six pills on them, you know, that's a little bit different, because then the probability changes.
Putting the pills one to one side for the moment and getting back to the Chief Justice's question, what we do have is a statement in the affidavit from a past proven reliable confidential informant that this defendant admitted that he was now selling drugs, including oxycodone, from his house. Why isn't that enough to constitute substantial deference under any test?
Because it's the Supreme Court, and every court requires corroboration, and it's simply information. So if you have a past reliable that says that somebody has a dead body in their basement or has drugs in their basement, unless you have an investigation to carry that out, and the problem here is that the these search warrant affidavits are the work product of police investigation, and it's a good thing that sometimes the search warrants get quashed because it keeps the police work more diligent, and it's a better quality of law enforcement than we would have otherwise. Thank you. I'm out of time.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is John Deckers. I'm here on behalf of appellee Michael Holden. The trial court in this case was obviously troubled by the lack of corroboration. And I think there's two ways to characterize the trial court's analysis of the totality of the circumstances. One way to look at it is to suggest, as the state has, that the court was substituting its own judgment, its own recipe, if you will. But the trial court also took note on at least one or two occasions that it was not substituting its own judgment, that it was not suggesting that you need a controlled buy in every case or that you need X, Y, or Z in every case. The other way to look at this is...
Then why even discuss that other factor that's not present?
And I think it's because of the other way to look at when a court in an intelligent manner analyzes the totality of the circumstances. You want to place averments within a context. And how do we place them in a context? We know that there are decisions where this court, the Supreme Court, has found probable cause to exist. We know that there are decisions where this court, the U.S. Supreme Court, have found probable cause to not exist. And so that's what the court was doing in this instance. It was not substituting its own judgment. It was not suggesting its own recipe, but it was comparing and contrasting because this court was obviously troubled by the amount of corroboration. And Justice Jacobs, I think that what the trial court concluded was that there was that there needed to be a greater weight of evidence in this case. Each one of these factors is a step. Past proven reliable informant is a step. Pfeiffer coming out of the residence with oxycodone is a step. But when you're analyzing the totality of the circumstances, we're not suggesting that you look to what's not in the warrant, but we cannot also ignore how the independent police investigation that did occur in this case discredited the averments which were contained within that same four corners. It's impossible to not consider when the reviewing court is obligated to consider the reliability of the information provided. The court cannot ignore that there were significant areas where the police investigation discredited the informants.
Would you agree that two different judges could reach different conclusions on any given affidavit as to whether it was sufficient and properly do so, that they would both be correct reaching different decisions?
I think so, and so
we've got one judge, a magistrate, saying, yes, this is enough, and another judge looking at it and saying, oh, I don't think so. Is that the way it's going to be resolved?
Well, I misinterpreted, I suppose, the initial question. I was thinking of the reviewing court, the superior court level. Could two judges look at it and come to alternate conclusions? I think that with the human element, even in judging, that yes, individuals can look at the same set of facts. However,
isn't that why the standard is to, there's already been one independent judge saying this is sufficient to support a warrant, and if that is questioned, another judge looking at it says, I'm going to start out and I'm going to give deference to what the first judge found, and I'm only going to reverse that if that was clearly wrong.
Well, I don't know if we should be using the term clearly wrong or that clearly erroneous standard. I think the question is, did the Superior Court abuse its discretion when engaging in this lengthy analysis of the facts? Something that we haven't talked about yet that I think adds a little bit of a wrinkle to this particular fact pattern is this. There was information contained within the search warrant application that should not have been considered by the magistrate, and that was the previously suppressed evidence. It's unclear how much, if at all, the magistrate relied upon that previously excluded suppressed evidence. And so, candidly, I think when you have a situation like that, I think the Superior Court ought to engage in a little bit more of an intelligent and lengthy analysis to properly evaluate the totality of the circumstances.
We heard from Mr. Foley that there's a public policy argument here that there should be, in effect, a certain percentage of times when warrants are overturned, or the issuance of warrants are overturned in order to police the police. Isn't there a countervailing public policy that review of the issuance of search warrants should be circumspect by reviewing courts because we want to encourage the police to seek a warrant rather than attempt to search without one?
I believe that absolutely that's the jurisprudence. And so the question here for this court is what's the value in suppressing this evidence? Does that serve a valuable function? And we think that it does. What it does do is it reaffirms two things. It reaffirms that the Superior Court is not a mere rubber stamp, but it also encourages, and we don't say that the police officer has to be a legal historian, but it encourages proper police work. It encourages intelligent police work, which corroborates the information provided by other sources. And so the deterrent value in suppressing this type of evidence serves a valuable function.
Thank you.
I believe that Mr. Foley did properly articulate the standard that we would suggest, and I heard Justice Berger say it most clearly most recently. Basically, if reasonable minds can disagree, then deference goes to the warrant at the issuing magistrate.
Well,
that didn't happen.
Ask your question in that regard about the last issue, which was the reference to the illegally seized evidence on an earlier occasion. If reasonable minds could differ, when you add that to the equation, how does it kind of tip the scales of justice if the magistrate's thinking, you know, this could go either way? But they're telling me he got away with something before. I'm not going to let him get away with it again. I'm going to issue the warrant.
Your Honor, one, I think that if you read the actual averments that speak about the prior investigation, none of them ever say, well, so it's more likely he has drugs because he did it before. You know, this is somebody who's in the drug game. That's not what they're saying at all. In fact, it's always mentioned in a way that corroborates what the confidential informant tells him. This is why he's doing it. It shows their relationship with him, that these confidential informants are somebody that he trusts, that he's going to speak to, that he's going to explain why he's changed his MO now from going from the car to the house. But never is it simply, we believe that it's more probable that he has drugs this time because he had drugs on a prior occasion. And if that was the averment, and if that was the reasonable reading of the affidavit, we would agree that should be excised out. just like we do in a Franks-type situation. But that's not what those averments are about at all. They only speak about the prior investigation and the confidential informant's knowledge of it and what he is saying about it as to why he's changing and where the drugs would now be as opposed to previously when he used to deliver them with his car.
All right. I believe that a few moments ago you stated or you agreed that if reasonable minds could disagree, then you know, then the round goes to the magistrate. That is, the substantial deference means that the magistrate's judgment ought to prevail on review.
Yes.
But doesn't even that analysis require a certain quantum of evidence for therefore there to be a reasonable inference?
Well, I think
that it's more probable than not that drugs were being sold from the home.
Your Honor, I think that if...
let me say it differently. Isn't substantial deference the tail? And what's really what we're trying to get at is the dog. That is, what are we really looking for? And aren't we looking for that quantum of evidence that would constitute probable cause?
I think that when we talk about substantial, if this hinges on the term substantial, Mr. Foley takes a view of substantial by one definition, and that is that it must be great or weighty. Substantial also means of substance.
All right. But,
and that's the review this court uses
regularly. Substantial evidence may just be a default. It may just be a burden of proof when the inferences are in equipoise. But to have inferences in equipoise that have any legal significance, at least one of the inferences has got to be that there's enough here to conclude that it's more probable than not that Mr. Holden was selling drugs from his house.
Yes.
Isn't that correct?
That there's a fair probability.
You there, you don't have any inference.
Yes, and we would suggest that when you look at the facts laid out in the affidavit of probable cause, that a reasonable mind can say, yes, there is a fair probability from all of these averments and what the police have said they have seen themselves and what the confidential informants are able to tell us and what they saw on April 4th and stopping Mr. Pfeiffer, there's a fair probability that drugs are being dealt by Mr. Holden, and they're being dealt out of that home right now. They did it within an hour of stopping Pfeiffer. So there's...
If you isolate the Pfeiffer incident from everything else that's in the affidavit, does that constitute, or does it show a fair probability, or does that episode have to be combined with other evidence?
I believe that it has to be combined with what the confidential informants are saying. It's very difficult. Because the police would have to take out of their mind, this is what we're investigating, the selling of oxycodone out of that home.
All right.
If, in fact, they stop Mr. Pfeiffer and all he said, that he has oxycodone on him, they just saw him come from that house, and he says, I didn't come from that house, which
the
sounds like what he said.
That, the response that we're hearing, at least that I'm hearing, is that, yes, there may have been a confidential informant that stated defendant admitted that he was selling drugs from the house, but that had to be corroborated, and it wasn't.
I believe that there may have even been sufficient probable cause without the Mr. Pfeiffer incident. I think that the corroboration came from, one, the fact that there's two different confidential informants telling you the same thing, basically. He's changed his operation. He's selling from the home. He's selling these specific things from his home. He is related to that home because...
Well, he had just one confidential information. Would his information have to be corroborated?
To some extent, yes.
But if you have two that are saying the same thing, you don't have to have corroboration?
I'm not saying that you don't have to have corroboration. They are internally corroborative in some ways, but there are also the things that the police are doing. That is, he says he's now using this car. They go and check, and they see, yes, he is driving that car. The confidential informant happens to know who that car is registered to. Says it's not registered to him, it's registered to the father-in-law. They check. Gosh, that's true. They do, from the outside of the home, at least do what they can to corroborate it that we can see in the affidavit.
Well, I guess the question is, do they have to have independent corroboration of the fact or of the claim that Mr. Holden was selling drugs out of his house, independent of what the CI stated?
That's a closer call. I believe historically this court certainly has upheld searches where there was no specific controlled by or something like that, but it would have been based primarily on confidential informant information and corroboration that didn't have specifically drugs coming out of the house, like I said, a controlled by or something like that. But I'd have to look a little further. I think that's a tougher call. That's the best answer.
If there were only one CI.
One CI with no corroboration with the drugs coming out of the house?
No, with just one CI. Yes, and no corroboration, no eyewitness, who saw.
That likely would not be enough.
All right. Does adding another CI change that equation?
I believe it does, because from everything we see here, what we have are two independent CIs now, it appears, from two different agencies. One is dealing with the DEA, one's dealing with another police agency, as I recall.
But they're two independent, uncorroborated CIs.
Well, there's some corroboration. I mean, there's not the drugs coming right out of the house, but I mean...
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Yes, but I do believe that when you have those two independent sources, that's true. They don't have the corroboration of a controlled by or something like that. But I'd suggest that it certainly advances the ball pretty far when you have two separate confidential informants, one who's definitely been defined as past proven reliable, and then another from a different agency telling you, here's what he's doing and here's why he's doing it. They have information that Holden isn't just spreading around to everybody. He's not telling you or I this. He's telling confidants this. Here's why I would change. Here's what happened to me. And I would suggest that gets us to that point. There are no further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and assess.